Thank you. Good morning, everybody, and I hope you're well. Before we do get to the source sheet, I do want to continue some aspects of an introduction that I think are very important. I had mentioned last week that there were three developments in the 16th century that brought Agada to great, great prominence. And again, they were all in the aftermath of the expulsion of the Jews from Spain and the growth of Kabbalah. The first I mentioned was the Ein Yaakov. The Ein Yaakov was the compilation of Agadot from the Babylonian, and in part from the Jerusalem Talmud, by Rav Yaakov Ibn Chabib, who also compiled commentaries on the Agada. The second was the great, great work of the Maharal of Prague that we talked about briefly, and I'm going to say some more about the Maharal, but I literally did not mention the third development that at least I want to mention briefly, and that is the great, great commentary of the Maharsha. The Maharsha, which is Morenu Shmuel Eliezer, that was his name, wrote one of the classic commentaries on the Gemara. Every single Gemara will always have the commentary of the Maharsha in the back. He emphasizes not pilpul, not intricate, questions and answers, but in-depth, fundamental understanding of pshat. And the Maharal wrote both Chidushei Halacha on the halachic portions of the Gemara and Chidushei Agada, and he actually insisted that they always be printed together. He forbade the printing of the Halacha without the Agada, because otherwise people might ignore the Agada. The Chidushei Agada of the Maharsha, they're printed in different fonts. The Chidushei Halacha is a little bigger, Chidushei Agada is very small. And one of the ways religious optometrists like to test the vision of B'nai Torah is, can you read the Chidushei Agada of the Maharsha? Unfortunately, I've reached a level where I do have difficulty, so I buy bigger versions of that and the like. So the Maharsha is really a fundamental commentary on Agada, but to some degree, his interest is a little different than the Maharal. The Maharal is more perhaps of a symbolic thinker. What the Maharsha tries to do is, the Maharsha tries to show you if Chazal offer a certain interpretation based on a biblical verse. He likes to show you the syntax and the grammar of the verse, how it fits a drasha, because often a drasha seems very, very far-fetched and not connected to the pasuk. So the Maharsha is more of the craftsman who shows you exactly how the drasha of Chazal interprets the pasuk. Very, very useful. But as I say, the Maharal tends to be a bit more expansive in symbolic thought. Again, that's an oversimplification because the Maharal does a lot of what the Maharsha does, and the Maharsha does a lot of what the Maharal does, but I would say that their primary emphasis is a little different. Now, let me just mention, just for your bibliographic familiarity, that much, much earlier, there was another great compilation of Agada, not only from the Gemara, but from the Midrash, anthologizing everything, and this is the Yalkut Shimoni. Now, Yalkut Shimoni. Now, the Yalkut Shimoni is not a medrash. The Yalkut Shimoni dates from the 1100s or the 1200s. It's a medieval work, but it is an anthology following the order of the Bible, not only on the Torah, but also the Nevi'im and the Kesuvim. So if you want to know, it's still tremendously useful. You're learning the book of Shmuel. And you want to know everything Chazal said about this given pasuk in Shmuel, whether it's from the Bavli, the Yerushalmi, or the Midrash, you can take the Yalkut Shimoni and look it up, and you will have all of the Chazals. So it's very interesting if we compare the Yalkut Shimoni and the Ein Yaakov, both of which are collections of Agada. There are a lot of differences. The Yalkut Shimoni is arranged in the order of Psukim. The Ein Yaakov is arranged in the order of the tractates of the Talmud. Right? Now, another difference is, however, since the Yalkut Shimoni is arranged in the order of Psukim, it will only give you Agadata that is connected to Psukim. Now, I mentioned last week, there are many Agadot, like Rabbi Akiva's story or the like, that are not connected to Psukim. You're not going to find them in the Yalkut Shimoni. So, on one hand, the Yalkut Shimoni is tremendously helpful, because it connects the Agadot to their sources in Tanakh, but it's going to be a little incomplete because the Agadot that are not connected to Psukim are not going to be there. Now, let me fast forward to something that is not at all connected to this time frame. It is really an early 20th century work Anagada. That is a third scheme of organization that is really very, very fascinating. And this is a topical organization of Agada. In other words, let's say you want to know, what do Chazal say about Tzedakah? What do Chazal say about Gemilas Chesed? What do they say about Limud HaTorah? Now, it'll be hard to find that in the Ein Yaakov, because since the Ein Yaakov follows the order of tractates, there may be many, many statements about Torah in many, many tractates. Similarly with the Alkit Shimoni, if you don't have your Pasuk, you're not going to know where to go. There is no index, fundamentally, to the Yalkut Shimoni or to the Midrashim generally, although Sansino actually did produce an index, which could be helpful. So we have topical collections of Agados, which are organized based on theme. Tzedakah, Chesed, this is ideal for a bar or bat mitzvah, etc. You want to know all the Mamar Chazal on a theme. So an earlier collection is the Menorah Tamaor, which is a famous Musar Sefer, and that dates from the 16th century. Actually, so that actually is around the time of the Maral. A later collection, and again, perhaps I should, because Rechavi, I guess I could be a little more liberal, is the great collection by Bialik and Ravnitsky called Sefer HaGadah. And Sefer HaGadah takes the Agadot of the Bavli, Yerushalmi, and Midrash. It translates them from Aramaic into Hebrew with a very, very brief commentary. It's also been translated in English. And the strength of the Sefer Agadah is not necessarily its completeness. It is not complete. Bialik did not include things he kind of disagreed with on some level. But it is topical. So it's very, very helpful. You want to know, what do Chazal say about Tzedakah, about Tshuva? Right? So we have three different organizational principles in Agadic collections. These are secondary sources. These are not the original Midrashim. We have the Yalkut Shimoni on the Seder of Tanakh. We have the Ein Yaakov on the Seder of Masechta, and we have the Menorat HaMaor, and later the Sefer Agadah, which is a topical organization and the like. Of course, I should say, Menorat HaMaor, Sefer Agadah, and Yalkut Shimoni include Midrashim, and not just things in the Talmud. Ein Yaakov is indeed limited only to the passages in the Talmud. The Ein Yaakov does not do the Midrash and the like. So these are just things to be aware of, and as I say, Sefer Agadah is in English as well, Menorat HaMaor is in English, Yalkut Shimoni has not been translated into English, but on the other hand, many of the primary sources, the Midrash Rabbah, long ago was translated by Sansino into English, and Art Scroll is putting out a Midrash Rabbah as well, which is very useful. They have, you know, commentary and the like. So, and of course, the Ein Yaakov. There is an old translation of Ein Yaakov I remember as a kid, and you can get it for free on HebrewBooks.org. It's the orange-covered Beis Yaakov, Ein Yaakov. Perhaps you remember it from synagogues. That was translated all the way back in the 1920s by a Rav Gluck, and that's still a very good translation. And then there's a more recent one by Rabbi Finkel, which is a big fat book. Which is only in English. It does not have the Hebrew text with it. So, once again, some of these things are available online for free, etc. As I say, the 1920 Ein Yaakov thing is on HebrewBooks.org, a very interesting website. So, Agada can, there are resources in Agada, and I'm only mentioning some of them that are going to be very, very useful. Okay. One more point. We largely talked about the Maral last week. I don't want to repeat, but there's one additional point I do want to talk about with the Maral. And that is, as I say, the Maral wrote many, many, many svarim. Many svarim. The Kitzvei Maral run to over 20 volumes, etc. And some of the volumes have more than one sefer. The Maral was renowned as a posek, but again, the primary focus of all of his svarim is exposition of the symbolic language of Agada. He saw Agada as a code, and he saw his life's mission to crack the code to show how Chazal communicate deep spiritual truth within metaphor and mashal and parable and hyperbole. And therefore, the dichotomy that people always ask, are Agadot true or are they not true? Once again, I'm repeating this. Maral says that's a false choice. The issue is not true or not true. Certainly, they're true. But what does it mean to be true? True is not necessarily literal truth. That's the Maral's key idea. And unlike other commentaries that may say that as a statement, Maral, as I said, puts the rubber to the road. He goes through Agada after Agada after Agada after Agada to actually show you this. He doesn't just say it as a generality. But there's one work of the Maral that, in a sense, is the key to his whole thought. Most of the works either discuss themes, like Pirkei Avos, or they discuss Agadas. But there's one book that is really his methodology of how he approaches Chazal, and this is the famous book Be'er HaGola. Now, Be'er HaGola has actually also been translated in English. Rabbi Yitzchak Adlerstein of Los Angeles has translated it. I think it's called an adaptation, actually. It's not an actual translation, but he tries to get it in. Let me explain what Be'er HaGola is. First of all, it's a very strange title. What exactly is well, we know Be'er means a well. That much we know. What is Gola? So the truth of the matter is, the Maral is a little enigmatic. It could mean the well of revelation, the galots, to reveal truths. It could refer to the galuts, the revelation that is needed in times of darkness and exile, etc. It could also be gula. In fact, some have suggested it's be'er ha-gula, which is probably not what is intended, and that would refer, gula is also a mayan, an ever-gushing stream of insight. And this is Maharal's defense of Chazal against a number of attacks. Now, he doesn't entirely make clear who are the attackers. And historians and scholars are still debating whose criticisms is he trying to answer. Some have suggested he was answering attacks of the Catholic Church. This was shortly after the Talmud was burnt. Volumes of the Talmud were burnt in France, etc. And the Talmud was constantly attacked by the Church, censored. And not only censored, but there were Jewish apostates that were adding fuel to the fire, right? By basically accusing the Talmud of being anti-Christian and everything else. And we talked a little bit about censorship last week. The Maral addresses these types of questions. Number one, is the Talmud anti-non-Jews? Or even ignorant Jews? For example, there are statements that say, an Am Haaretz, you're allowed to break his neck even on Yom Kippur that falls on Shabbos. a little scary. So the Maral kind of explains those things. He addresses attacks about Chazal were ignorant of science. For example, there's a Gemara in Sukkah that says that the reason eclipses occur when the sun gets blocked is because of certain sins in the generation. And this is contradictory to scientific understanding. Let me point out, by the way, that Prague in the Maral's time, there were great astronomical discoveries in particular. There was Tycho Brahe, I think that's how you pronounce his name, a great astronomer. This was shortly after Copernicus. So there was, Galileo's around that time, meaning this is the beginning of the Renaissance, the beginning of the Enlightenment. And therefore the Maral is a transitional figure between the faith-based community of the Middle Ages and the modern scientific communities of the Renaissance. And Prague was a major crossroads. And the Maral tries to show that Chazal are not ignorant of science, but the Maral's approach is that science gives what you might call proximate causes. So, for example, let's take the Torah itself, a rainbow. The Torah itself, forget about Chazal, the Torah itself says a rainbow is God's sign that he's not going to destroy the world anymore by a flood. And that is why a rainbow looks like an inverted bow, as if the bow is going away from the earth. Now, the Maral says, forget about Chazal. The question is, what do you mean? We know what a rainbow is. A rainbow is when light, undifferentiated light, strikes water, drops, it breaks into a prism. You see colors. It has nothing to do with some special reason. So the Maral explains very beautifully, how do you understand that? He says like this. Certainly, the immediate proximate cause of rainbows is light striking drops of water. But God is the creator of laws of nature. And God could have made laws of nature any one of a trillion ways. God could have made light multicolored that when it strikes water, it turns into a white beam. Or, refraction itself is a creation. So the Maral says, science deals with immediate causes. But the Torah, and by extension Chazal, deal with ultimate causes. So when Chazal say eclipses were put into the world to give us fear, to give us reverence, to cause us to do tshuva, they are not denying scientific explanations. They are simply saying, why did God orchestrate scientific laws to produce such effects when Hashem could have made the effects another way? Very, very important. In other words, ultimate cause versus immediate proximate cause. Science can tell you the immediate causes of things, but they can't tell you why. I mean, you know, you can talk about a Big Bang, you can talk about evolution, I'm not going to get into that, but the Maharal even suggests, in kind of a drop, that, you know, this is way before Darwin. You know, evolution, whatever, who cares? In other words, how God created the world is not even a religious question, as long as you believe that God created the world. Hashem has infinite tools in his palette. He could have used this tool, he could have used this tool. And science is simply an after-the-fact understanding of what tool did Hashem use, but it does not really address the issue. Right, so this is really, again, obviously with science, you know, advancing, you know, we refine these ideas, but the Maharal is the originator of this type of approach to science and conflict, science and religion. And indeed, that is why he is a very pioneering figure, and I should say that Rav Kook, which we'll get to, was very much influenced. Maharal is one of the great influences on Rav Kook, both in terms of symbolic thinking and in understanding that there really is no conflict between science and religion because they are addressing two different aspects of reality. Science addresses the what, and religion addresses the why, and science can give no answer to a why. There is no why. Science cannot explain why Big Bang, why this, why that, why that. That is ultimately a question beyond the purview of science. And this is really an approach that is grounded in the Maharal. So what's interesting is this diffuses a lot of the questions people have. That is why rabbinic Judaism, now today is a little different, today we're almost going backwards in some ways, but that is why in the Middle Ages even, rabbinic Judaism did not have the problem with scientific discoveries that the Catholic Church had. You know, the Catholic Church, number one, it persecuted Copernicus, because if you say that the earth goes around the sun, the earth is no longer the Tachlis Habriya. Galileo, of course, we know, was forced to recant his ideas. But the Maharal says, Copernicus, Schmernius, whoever it is, we can take all of these guys and we can work with them one way or the other. Meaning to say, they are not a contradiction to anything. Right, so this is in the Ber Hagola. And then, Maharal has another, so just to address some of the questions. The attitude of Chazal to Goyim and to ignorant Jews, right, the Maharal kind of gives you symbolic interpretations. Whether Chazal were ignorant of science, and how do you reconcile rabbinic teachings with scientific understandings as we have them? A third question that he addresses is that rabbinic interpretations of biblical verses often seem far-fetched, that violate the rules of grammar, violate syntax, and here the Maharal kind of plays the role of the Marsha, in which he shows you how Chazal paid exquisite attention to grammar and syntax, and what you think is far-fetched is actually built into the language if you truly understand the Hebrew language and the grammatical structure. By the way, the Gauntlet was later taken by the Malbim in the 19th century, who used this. You know, the Reform movement was growing in the 19th century, and one of their arguments was rabbinic Judaism is a totally artificial construct superimposed on the meaning of biblical texts, and the Malbim devoted his life's career to showing how rabbinical understandings of Tanakh are based on fundamental grammar and syntax. In fact, I have to say this, just as a digression, that, you know, I always think to myself, the Reform movement may be guilty of a lot of things, but they're going to get a certain amount of Olam Haba, because they are responsible for wonderful, wonderful biblical commentaries of the 19th century that were written in response to the challenge of the Reform movement. It is only because of the Reform movement that we have the Malbim. It is only because of the Reform movement that we have Rav Shimshon Raphael Hirsch. It is only because of the Reform movement that we have the Ksava HaKabbalah, which is a little less known, but it's a wonderful sefer. Kabbalah does not mean mysticism. It means the tradition of Chazal, where he tries to reconcile the pshad and the psukim with the drushes of Chazal, and to some degree the Nitziv and the Meshech Chachma are also connected. Now the 19th century saw a flowering, a renaissance of beautiful biblical interpretation, all of which are devoted to showing how Chazal's words are pshuto shel mikra, and I have to say the Reform movement was the prad that created this. So who knows? HaKadosh Baruch Hu can give people schar for all sorts of unintended. This was not their intention, granted, but nevertheless, it was done. So this is Ber HaGolah. So Ber HaGolah is extremely, extremely important because in a sense, although it was not the Maharal's first work, in a sense, it is his methodology on which all of his other works are based. Now, I said that who is the Maharal addressing? The Catholic Church. Now, you might wonder, if you're addressing the Catholic Church, why do you write a book in Rabbinic Hebrew? That's hardly the language that you would use. So obviously, I think we have to assume that the Maharal was not interested in debating with Catholics, although we have some historical record that he actually did. The Maharal was concerned that these ideas were permeating Jewish consciousness, and therefore he felt a need to help Am Yisrael to understand the great exaltedness of Chazal. Because of this, by the way, because the Maharal had such a reverence for Chazal, and he refused to accept that there was anything artificial about their teaching, there were even some great rabbis that he disagreed with. For example, he was very negative on the Ibn Ezra. The Ibn Ezra, who lived much earlier, the Ibn Ezra lived in the 1100s, often, the Ibn Ezra was a great grammarian, and he often would say that the halacha, we accept Chazal, but their interpretation is not grammatical and the like. The Maharal is very, very harsh on the Ibn Ezra. Even the Abarbanel, who sometimes does the same thing, and the Abarbanel is one of our great Mefarshim, Maharal doesn't like certain, in other words, the Maharal doesn't like the Mefarshim of Pshat, who sometimes say, now Chazal, maybe not so correct. Maharal is really a fierce, fierce defender of the holiness of Chazal and of the accuracy of Chazal. Now, there was one contemporary of the Maharal who especially incurred the Maharal's wrath, and in fact this person was quite confused. This person was a Shomer Torah Mitzvot. He was an absolutely observant Jew. He was a very learned Jew, but he was a Jew who was very well versed in secular wisdom as well. He was a doctor, he was a historian, and he wrote a book that was very, very popular at the time, around the same time as the Maharal. It is called Ma'or Einayim, The Light of the Eyes, and the Mechaber was a man in Italy, Rabbi Azaria de Rossi, which is translated in Hebrew, Azaria min Adumim. Again, he came from a part of Italy that was called the Red Country because of the soil. Azaria de Rossi. And he wrote a book, and this is really from a scholarship standpoint, this is a pioneering book. It's called Ma'or Einayim, because Ma'or Einayim, again, he was a religious Jew, but he goes through all of the historical references in Chazal, and he tries to pinpoint whether they were accurate or not, and he concludes often that Chazal did the best that they could, they were great and wise people, but their historical records are sometimes incorrect for various reasons, and he was the first Jewish scholar to use Philo of Alexandria, who was a Jewish philosopher, but only the Christians used him. He was the one who brought Philo, he called him Yedidya, Alexandrini. He brought him into the Jewish world. He used Josephus, and he would use Philo and Josephus to try to understand Chazal, and sometimes to point out that Chazal were in error on various historical issues, such as the duration of the Bayit Sheni, and again, and Rabbi Weinshol, I'm always reluctant to talk about history too much because you might be a lot more knowledgeable than I am. So this was an enormously interesting and popular book, and it's still a very interesting book in some ways, because he takes Josephus, and he takes Philo, and he takes Chazal, and he collates them, and he shows the differences between them and the like. And it was very, very popular. Maharal writes in Ber HaGolah that people were telling him he really had to read this book, and he was very excited, he says, he was very excited. But then he says, the more he read, the more he realized he has to do kriya, he has to rip his garments, that this is a desecration of the Torah. Really, if I would be Azaria de min Adumim, I would be quite upset. And he said that this is a bikursus, and he says, it used to be that only the Goyim were attacking Chazal. And now we have religious Jews doing the same. He says, alas to the generation that has to see this. And he devotes a whole chapter of the Ber HaGola to a great, great attack on Azariah d'min HaDumim. And as I say, I want to emphasize, Azariah d'min HaDumim was not an Abikar, I mean, well, Abikar, whether he was an Abikar, that depends. Morel says he was, but as a religious Jew, he certainly was a Shomer Torah Mitzvos. He was halachically observant. He had deep respect for Chazal, even when he said that they were wrong on different things. It was never in a disrespectful way, but the Maral considered that to be kfira apikorsis. What is interesting is you might have figured that after that point, Azariah d'min HaDumim would be like Acher, and nobody ever looked at his work again. But you know, it's a funny thing. It continued to be used, and the Tosfos Yomtov, who was the Maharal's disciple and successor in Prague, you know, quotes the Amorei Na'im for historical data. In other words, it's as if to say they understood the Maharal was simply against a particular aspect of the book, but was not necessarily saying it was a worthless book. Again, it's very strange, because the Maharal's language is so strong and so powerful, but people continue to read the book anyway for whatever it is. There is, by the way, for those of you that are interested, maybe, I shouldn't tell you Maharal Na'im, but a professor, Joanna Weinberg, has translated the whole Maharal Na'im, so it's something like 1,200 pages. And it's a very expensive book. It's $100. But you can get it, the University Press is that type of book, but you can get it on Amazon.com. But I would advise that you buy it together with your Ber HaGola copy, which is much cheaper. The Ber HaGola is $20, and the Maharal Na'im is like $100. So it just shows you that sometimes price is not indicative of ultimate value. But then as long as you have your Ber HaGola vaccination, you can look at the Maharal Na'im with a certain amount of great benefit. Because there are very, very interesting historical studies. In fact, Rav Azariah d'min HaDumim is considered to be the founder of the systematic study of Jewish history. So he actually does have an important role in the history of scholarship. And most of his stuff is not objectionable in any particular way. Okay. So these are kind of the developments in the 16th century. And again, I apologize for the introduction, but I think these are what are called yidiot nechutzot. These are useful information and perspectives to have on this. Now, let's flash forward to the 19th and 20th century. Now we have another figure that is great in Agadita, and that is great in many, many areas. And that is the towering, amazing personality of a Avraham Yitzchak HaKohen Cook, a person, once again, one thing that we have to say about people who are extraordinarily deep thinkers, that they are complex and they are contradictory, at least on a superficial level, because they embrace many, many different perspectives. And what you tend to have with complex, brilliant, deep figures is different disciples latch on to different aspects of it, but they only have an incomplete picture. This is true about Rav Yosher Ber Soloveitchik, although he's not our subject, in which the philosopher people look at him as a philosopher, primarily. And the Talmudists, like Rav Schechter, look at him as a Talmud Chacham. And people are not grasping the totality of his picture. The truth of the matter is, a true Gadol is going to be multifaceted. Rav Cook was a multifaceted person, and that is why to this very day in the state of Israel, he is either reviled, or he is worshipped, or there is a contested legacy. People who admire Rav Cook, they emphasize different aspects of him, some of which are contradictory. We have the Gush Emunim people, the Merkas Harav people, who basically say Rav Cook's central teaching was the sanctity of the land of Israel that you can't give up no matter what. Then you have Rav Amital, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, who said, not really. The legacy of Rav Cook was humanitarianism and compassion and morality, which means you got to make peace. Again, I'm not getting into specifics of politics here, but they're looking at the same person, the same rabbi. They're reading the same books. They have the same admiration. And one sees in Rav Cook, you don't give up land no matter who dies. And the other sees in Rav Cook, the need to sanctify God's name by peace and harmony again, I'm not endorsing any particular stance here. I'm just trying to show you that there's a contested legacy. Compare Rav Tzvi Yehuda Kook with Rav Amital. And you see right there, they both had the same spiritual guide. Of course, Rav Tzvi Yehuda was Rav Kook's son. But they took different things. Which is right? The answer is they're both right. Rav Kook was a man of contradictions because he saw the totality of the world. It's like a famous children's story. The blind man, seven blind men and the elephant, maybe you remember that. Seven blind people feel an elephant. They're asked to describe what they feel. So somebody feels the trunk and they say, oh, an elephant is like a big snake. And somebody feels the ears. Oh, the elephant is like a gigantic butterfly. And someone feels the stomach and says, oh, the elephant is a hippopotamus. Well, are they right? Yeah, they're all right. The elephant has something like a snake, and the elephant has something like a gigantic butterfly, and the elephant has something like a hippopotamus. The answer is they're all correct, but they only see part of a total reality. By the way, the Maharal himself, going back, makes that point about Agada. When you have arguments in Agada, this happened or this happened, he's saying it's not a question of either or. Each is describing a different facet of a total reality. I mean, that's Maharal's approach generally, and certainly that is how you have to approach people like Rav Kook, which is why, as I say, people like Rav Soloveitchik on different issues than Rav Kook, and people like Rav Kook have what are called contested legacies. You know, you take the Satmar Rebbe, who was great in his own way as well, and he was a great person. The Satmar Rebbe tended to be focused on one or two particular issues. So as a result, you can tend to know exactly where he stands. People like Rav Kook tended to be focused on many, many universalist issues. So it's much harder to pinpoint exactly where that person stands. Rav Kook was a child of the Lithuanian Torah community. We forget this. Rav Kook was a classical gadol in an era of many, many gadolim, Shas, Bavli, Yerushalmi, Shulchan Aruch, Rishonim, Achronim. Rav Kook was not just a poetic free spirit, you know, who liked to go on kibbutzim. I mean, he was a person. When he was a student, he was only 16 to 18 in the great Volozhin Yeshiva, and he was a student of the Netziv. Rav Kook was not even married. He was only 18 years old, 17, 18 years old. And he did three things that were unique in the Volozhin Yeshiva at the time. He was the only single bachur that had a beard. In those days, beards were reserved only for married people. Number two, he was given special rishus to wear tefillin all day. He said his heart required him to have God's presence within him and on him at all times. And the third was, in a yeshiva of many, many masmidim, he learned 18 to 19 hours a day. He was the greatest of the masmidim. But he was an unusual person because, in addition, Volozhin was filled with geniuses and masmidim as well. But Rav Kook was also a poetic soul, a mystical soul, a person that had a deep, deep yearning both for the learning of Kabbalah, but also to feel the presence of Hashem. And you have to know, the Lithuanian culture, it's a little strange to say this, was a little suspicious of people who had too much religious fervor. In other words, the yeshiva world, Volozhin in particular, was an extremely intellectual world. Even in the yeshiva world, intellectual. The idea was analytical understanding. That's the Yiddish expression, a kalte litvak, a cold litvak. Meaning chassidim in Poland, you know, warmth and dancing and singing. The litvak only appreciated cold analytical reasoning. So Rav Kook was frankly a little strange. On one hand, he was a brilliant, brilliant Talmud Chacham. On the other hand, poetic, mystical, emotional. He would daven for many, many hours. He wore tefillin all day. Who did that? Although the Vilna Gaon, in fact, did that, but that had not become the custom anymore. Even the Netziv didn't do it. The Rosh Yeshiva themselves did not do it. He loved Tanakh, which in Lithuanian yeshivas were highly discouraged, although he may have gotten that from the Netziv. The Netziv also had great interest in Tanakh and Diktuk. And because he was a Kohen, he felt very connected to the Beis HaMikdash. He would dream and yearn about the Beis HaMikdash and, of course, Eretz Yisrael itself. And what's interesting is that the Netziv, you know, there were two Rashi Yeshiva in Volozhin, two great Rashi Yeshiva during Rav Kook's time in Volozhin. One was the Netziv, Rav Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin, who had been Rashi Yeshiva for 50 years. He had been the main Rashi Yeshiva But the assistant Rosh Hashiva, who had married the Nitziv's granddaughter, was extremely popular, and he was conquering the world of the yeshiva. And this was none other than Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, who later became the Rav of Brisk, succeeding his father, which Rav Chaim started his career as junior Rosh Hashiva of Volozhin. And this is a fascinating story in and of itself, Rav Chaim's derech, deep analytical thinking. In fact, he was more popular than the Nitziv in terms of people gravitating. But Rav Kook gravitated to the Nitziv more than Rav Chaim. Because the Nitziv had a certain love for Eretz Yisrael. The Nitziv had a certain tolerance even for non-religious Jews. The Nitziv was a supporter of Zionism, although he wanted it to be religious Zionism through the Chov of Eitz Zion. But the Nitziv believed in collaboration even with the non-religious Zionist movements that were starting at the time. Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, and this is still the legacy of the Briskers in Israel today, says you are not allowed to work with Apikorsim, Kofrim, etc. So, in a way, the seeds of Rav Kook's philosophy are really from the Nitziv. So there is a Moreshet here. Rav Kook did not come out of nowhere, but the Nitziv was the type of Rebbe that Rav Kook would gravitate to, and indeed Rav Kook gave a very beautiful and moving eulogy, Hespin, when the Nitziv was Nifter. Rav Kook left Volozhin, he got married. Initially he was a Rav in Lithuania, a small shtetl in Lithuania, and small shtetls were very good. They didn't give you too much money, but they gave you a lot of time to sit and learn, and therefore a lot of his learning continued in these little shtetls. But eventually he came to Eretz Yisrael before World War I, and he became the Rav of Yaffa. Now, there was no Tel Aviv in those days. Tel Aviv started a little later. That's interesting. Initially, Tel Aviv was the tiny little shechuna adjacent to the larger town of Yaffa. Yaffa was never a big city, but, you know, Yaffa was a larger town than Tel Aviv. Eventually, what happened was the tail swallowed up the lion or whatever it would be. And Rav Kook was Rav of Yaffa. And the emes is, Rav Kook loved Yaffa in particular. What was Yaffa? It was basically a small town, a fishing village, simple Jews. He wasn't involved in national politics. He wasn't involved in the Zionist intrigues versus the Haredi world and the like. And Rav Kook was able to be makariv people. He was able to deal with people at their own level, etc. And as you know the story, during World War I, or before World War I, he went to Europe to attend the first Aguda convention in Katowice in Poland, or Vienna. I'm not sure, because one was Vienna, wasn't in Katowice. But basically, the outbreak of World War I stranded him. He was not able to come back to what was called Palestine. And he spent a number of years, not being able to return. He was separated from his family. He was separated from Eretz Yisrael. And he took a temporary job as a Rav of a Beit Knesset in London. He was a Rav in London for, I believe, 4 years, Machzikei Hadat. And, of course, he took the job with the express condition that the minute he is able to return to Eretz Yisrael, he will resign that position. But he stayed there for a number of years. At the end of World War I, in 1917 or 18, he was able to return to Eretz Yisrael. He returned to Yaffa. And in Yaffa, he had a very good relationship with all the Rabbanim, including the Rabbanim of Yerushalayim, simply because, in Yaffa he's doing his own thing in a little place. He's not trying to change the country in any way. So people got along. People got along. But then, eventually, he was invited to be Rav of Yerushalayim. Not of Palestine yet, but Rav of Yerushalayim. And that is the beginning of a very, very difficult tekufa in his life. Because as Rav of Yerushalayim, he was already involved. This is all pre-state, of course. He was already involved in determining the religious nature of the Yishuv, how it will relate to Zionists, how it will relate to Chilonim, what type of chinuch structures, and the like. And we know that Rav Kook's general approach, although once again he was a gaon in halacha and a posek of the first rank, certainly one of the gedolei haposkim, but his general idea grounded in his mystical vision of Am Yisrael, is that every Jew was holy, and everything that was done to build up the land of Israel was holy work and sacred work. And he said, even if a person comes to Israel and says, I don't believe in God, and they're coming because of nationalism or whatever it is, that's only their conscious mind. It is the spark in their neshama that is bringing them there. Rav Kook even writes in a very controversial way that secularism and rejection of Torah, although it's a bad thing, actually can be a means to create a certain spiritual renewal, because people were rebelling against superficiality. People were rebelling against just doing things out of rote. They wanted to discover spiritual truths on their own. And Rav Kook said, although it might be that in that process they're going up the wrong road, but lehepech, when they find the right road, there will be a newness, there will be a freshness, there'll be an enthusiasm. He saw in secularism, he saw that as the seed, very controversial, he saw that as the seeds of the renewal of a spiritual renaissance. Now, you can imagine there were many, many, many chashuv religious Jews who thought this was intolerable. They thought, oh, you're befriending Apikorsen. What later became the Eidah Charedis, you had, was Rav Yosef Chaim Zonnefeld, who personally was very close to Rav Kook as a friend, but ideologically they had very, very different approaches. How do you deal with secularism? And it's interesting, Rav Yosef Chaim Zonnefeld, always referred to Rav Kook as the Rav of Yafo. He never called him the Rav of Yerushalayim. And he explained, he said, what Rav Kook is doing was absolutely correct in Yafo. Small town, one-to-one, sure, be tolerant, be loving, be accepting, be non-judgmental. He says, it's exactly the approach on a one-to-one basis. But Rav Yosef Chaim Zonnefeld said, when you're dealing with how a community has to be structured, you have to be tough. You have to be unyielding. You can't compromise. Now, you may have heard, of course, that one of the most famous or infamous events, Rav Kook gave a speech at the founding of Hebrew University. And this is really very unfair. It just shows you how people get tarred and feathered in those days, either intentionally or not. And Rav Kook ended his speech with, Ki mitzion teitzei Torah, that from Zion Torah shall go out. And this was reported in the press and by the Kanoim, the zealous people, that Rav Kook considered the secular scholarship of Hebrew University to be the Torah that comes forth from Zion, from Mount Scopus. They said, look at what this man is doing. I want to point out, if you read the speech, and I did read this, at least part of the speech, you will see Rav Kook was making the opposite point. He was giving a little musser. He was saying, it's good to have chachma, it's good to have scholarship, but we have to remember that what emerged from Tzion is the Torah of Hashem. It's exactly the opposite. He was talking about the primacy of Torah, and yet he was relentlessly persecuted. So, on one hand, and of course we have the individual psukim like the Heter Mechira of Shemitah, which again, I mean, that's a halachic matter, but you know, that created and does create a lot of controversy to this very day. But here is our issue. Rav Kook saw holiness even in the secular. He saw holiness in the assimilated Jew that rejects Torah. He saw holiness even when people were playing soccer on Shabbos, which Rav Kook tried to stop. He tried to stop. But he said, in some way, they're strengthening their body and it can be turned to holiness. He was relentlessly attacked. He was called an apikores. I'm not just talking about criticized. Apikores, kofar, gehenim. Awful, awful, awful appellations. And Rav Kook was makabel on himself that he was not going to respond at all. His father, his parents, by the way, he was like, his parents came to Eretz Yisrael with him. His parents said, why don't you say something? He said, he is not going to respond at all. He says, his job is to love. His job is not to hate. His job is to spread wisdom and light. And there's in a very beautiful passage, I don't have it in front of me, where he says, the way of a wise person is to increase wisdom and not to criticize ignorance. It is to create light and not to curse darkness. And he says, he is not about criticizing anybody. And he said, he was grateful to the people who criticized him, because if there was something he needed to correct, he wanted to know about it. And they kept him, perhaps, from going to the other extreme in his love. They kind of pulled him back a little bit. And he said maybe he needed to be pulled back. Very, very humble, extraordinary, extraordinary great person. I just want you to know that you will sometimes hear in the modern Haredi world. To this day, Rav Kook is either ignored, at best ignored, and at worst is still reviled in different ways. But Rav Elyashiv, first of all, Rav Kook was the Masadr Kedushin for Rav Elyashiv. Rav Elyashiv, you know, married Rav Aryeh Levin's daughter, and Rav Kook made the Shidduch. Rav Kook was the Masadr Kedushin. And when Charedim, I don't mean to be anti-Charedim, but when Yeshiva people, B'nai Torah, whatever, in Yeshivos, would casually say something negative about Rav Kook, Rav Elyashiv would kick them out of the room. And he would say, you are ignorant, you have no idea who you're talking about. In the Frankel Rambam, there are Rambams that try to assemble collections of chidushim from different Gaonim. So Rav Kook was one of the people that had chidushim that could be appended, particularly on the laws of Zeraim, agriculture. So one of the editors did not include Rav Kook, or he took out, he was an editor, so he took out the references to Rav Kook because B'nai Torah should not read Rav Kook's Torah. So his boss, the supervisor, became more, and the supervisor fired him. So the person took his boss to Rav Elyashiv, you know, claiming he was wrongfully terminated because he just did what the yeshiva world said is the right thing to do. And Rav Elyashiv said, if I would have been your boss, I would have fired you much earlier. You know, this is a travesty and a great aveira. Rav Yisrael Zalman Meltzer, who is known as Rav Aaron Kotler's father-in-law, but he himself was a phenomenally great gadol, said about Rav Kook, he was a little younger than Rav Kook, he said about Rav Kook, where our godless in Torah, where the godless of every gadol ends, that is where Rav Kook's godless begins. That is where it begins. So, once again, depending where you go, you're either dealing with a hated figure, God, although it's hard to imagine how could you hate such a person, or an ignored figure, or a beloved figure. And those who love him may love him for different reasons. So even within the group of people who love him, some people love him because of his holiness of the land of Israel. Some people love him because of his love for Am Yisrael. And some people love him because he was also humanitarian in the sense of compassion for everybody. Right? He had this vision that you expand the notion of yourself. Yeah, you, in other words, he basically said, the only person you have to love is yourself. But what's the definition of the self? As a person gets greater, they understand that they're just like a cell. They're like a fingernail on part of a larger organism. The righteous person understands that self is not my finger. Self is me, but who is me? I am part of a collective. And that collective embraces the Jewish people and it eventually embraces all of Am Yisrael. So, just to give you an example, you know, Rav Yosher Ber Soloveitchik of Yeshiva University, the great Rav Yosher Ber Soloveitchik, only made one trip to Israel in the early 1930s. And as a young man, he was a relatively young man then. He was a young man then. He had a chance to meet Rav Kook shortly before his death. And just to give you an example of the impression Rav Kook made, he said that he did not agree with Rav Kook's Derech Halimut. You know, the Brisker Derech is not Rav Kook's Derech. And as I mentioned, Rav Kook was not connected to Rav Chaim Soloveitchik in religion. And Rav Soloveitchik himself, you know, was a Brisker. But he said, he couldn't even describe it. And Rav Soloveitchik was a man of tremendous articulation. He said, he was just the most unusual person I ever met. He said, I can't describe it exactly. He says, I've never met a person like him in my whole life. You know, that was kind of the impression that Rav Kook made on people. So Rav Kook is also, just as the Maharal, Rav Kook, in a sense, is a transition figure. Because on one hand, he is rooted, and we have to remember this, he is rooted in the world of the yeshiva. He is rooted in the world of learning Torah, 18, 20 hours a day. Shas and poskim. But he is confronting the challenges of modernity. The challenges of Jews drifting away from Yiddishkeit. And it's not even the reform movement anymore. We're talking about communism, socialism, Zionism, nationalism, in which Jews want to create a new type of Jew, not a Golus Yid anymore. And Rav Kook is trying to see in that ways that God is bringing the messianic redemption through Badafka in this particular way. Again, he died before there was a state. And it's fascinating that on his matzeva, on his kever, There's only three things, and it just shows you how he summarized his life. I'm sure he wrote the Nusach before he died. He said, the date that he, Allah li'aretz, he came to Eretz Yisrael, this date. Allah li'Yerushalayim, this date. Allah la'shamayim, last date. And this is how he saw his life. He saw his life as three stages of Aliyah. Eretz Yisrael, Yerushalayim, Shemayim. That is all that is on his mind. His name and the date. But it doesn't say, you know, what he was. It doesn't say Rav of anything. It just says, these are the three significant, what he considered, I have to assume he did it, because I'm sure if his son did it, he would have written something much more. I'm sure he instructed that this would be written on his Matseva. Okay. So, Rav Kook wrote quite a lot. He wrote Shuvas and Halacha, the famous book on Shemitah, Shabbat Haaretz, which is defense, halachically, of selling the land to non-Jews. Whether that should apply today is another question. I gave a shiur in the OU on it, so I'm not going to talk about that. He wrote books on Shuva, he wrote books. Actually, many of them were not books. Many of them were notebooks of reflections that had to be organized after his death. In fact, his editor was his great Talmud, Rav David Cohen, who was called the Nazir of Yerushalayim. He was a Nazir, Mamish a Nazir. And his son is Rav Shar Yashuv Cohen, who is the Rav of Haifa and a perennial candidate as for Rav HaRashi as well. His father was a Nazir. His father was a Nazir and a great Talmud of Rav Kook. And his father was actually the primary. He and Rav Tzvi Yehuda Kook were the primary editors of Rav Kook's notebooks. So Rav Kook, as a poetic person, his thoughts were often not organized. They were reflections that would come to him and the like. Well, one of Rav Kook's great projects, he had many, many projects. You know, he started the yeshiva, you know, the Merkaz HaRav Yeshiva, and he had a project for the Talmud in which every sugi in Shas would have a halachic appendix that would give you all of the halachic background. This is the Halacha Berura project that is still going on. Rav Kook created that. But Rav Kook also had an idea that he thought, and he is the one that coined the phrase, halacha is the body of Judaism, and agada is the neshama of Judaism. And he was convinced that through the symbolic truths of the agada, following Maral, the hearts and souls of Jews can be opened up to not just superficial observance, but to passionate renewal. And this would, of course, help the already religious to find a new way of connecting to life. But he also felt very strongly that this would be a key to opening the heart of the secular and those who rejected Judaism, when they would see that Judaism is not just a matter of ritual, but it's a matter of passionate engagement with God. And therefore, he had a project to write on the Agadot of Shas, and following the order of the Ein Yaakov. And the name of the Sefer is a bit of a pun, Ein Ayah, the eye of the Ayah. Now, Ayah is spelt Aleph Yud Hey. On one level, that is simply an abbreviation. The eye or the well, because Ein, just like Ein Yaakov, right, could be eye, could be well. Ayah is Avram Yitzchak HaKohen. But Ayah, with a slightly different spelling, with an ayin instead of an Aleph, is the name of one of the birds in the Torah, the non-kosher birds. And he actually writes that he writes with great humility that he is really nothing better than this kind of bird that simply flies around looking for little things it could eat here and there, and it doesn't really have insight, it doesn't really have understanding, but he prays that Hashem will give him the ability. So it's both a way of putting a Chazon Ish, right? Chazon Ish is the vision of Avraham Yeshayo. So Ein Ayah is the vision of Avraham Yitzchak HaKohen. Now, so far, we're still discovering different manuscripts of Rav Kook. So far, the Ein Ayah that we have is only on Maseches Brachos and on Maseches Shabbos, the first two tractates. Now, I have heard that we actually have notebooks on all of the Talmud. I'm not sure, because I've heard opposites, that Rav Kook didn't have a chance to finish it. Ein Ayah was initially written in Yafo. He started writing it very early, and it seems that he abandoned it for many, many years. Got too busy, but then, towards the end of his life, he went back to it again. So that seems to be inconsistent with the idea that he completed it. I mean, I hear two different stories on this, but at least what has been published is on Brachos and Shabbos. You know, you can get it, different places. But again, we live in a funny world. There are going to be farm stores that do not sell Rav Kook's writings. There's kind of a boycott, and the like. Other places will sell, etc. What we're going to be looking at are a bunch of passages, not too many actually, because this is not such a long, unless this year gets renewed or extended. We're going to be looking at a few passages from the Einaya and Maseches Brachos. We'll just take one tractate. And I'm going to try to offer you for each little passage what the Maharal says and what Rav Kook says. So that way you'll see, some overlap. But you'll also see different issues. Let me just mention one very important difference. Most of our Jewish svarim emphasize the importance of the individual. We talk about the individual having a relationship with God. Rav Kook, of course, talks about that as well. But for Rav Kook had a very, very powerful, strong, nationalistic, collective consciousness. And you will often find that he emphasizes not just how the individual connects to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, but how the individual strengthens the nation and enables the nation to connect to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So you'll find in Rav Kook that many agadot that the Maharal might interpret as referring to an individual situation, Rav Kook will often collectivize or nationalize in that particular way. Okay, so I guess we'll have to stop here. Again, I do apologize, but next week, Be'ezrat Hashem, we will actually begin with a text, and we're going to look at the little. If you have your source, we're really going to just do A. A is enough, and that is a source about the three divisions of the night. Division one, the donkey brays. Division two, the dogs bark. Division three, children are nursing. And what exactly does that mean? Okay.